And the premise of how they sold them in the 50s was your baby needs to exercise. So this is the number one lead baby exerciser. So it was brand new. Also, your baby will eat better and your baby will sleep better if you use this, right? So that's tying in diet culture to babies. Doesn't that blow your mind? Like diet culture is everywhere, but to actually prey on parents who just want a little bit of sleep and would really like their babies to eat well is just criminal, isn't it?
You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily Giles.
Hi, I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Untaming Podcast. Today it is the first quarter of the Hunger Moon here in the Southern Hemisphere. We passed a milestone last week. This podcast has now had a total of 50,000 total downloads from all over the world. I'm pleased that after 4 years, you're all still tuning in. And if you're really enjoying the content, please, I'd really appreciate you sharing your enjoyment in reviews on iTunes or Facebook or wherever else you can leave reviews. I hope you found last week's interview with Samantha Zipporah on fertility awareness helpful. I absolutely loved her point that people with sperm are fertile every single day, so they should really be stepping up to be responsible for the fact that they are fertile every day, whereas we are only fertile for 3 to 6 days out of every month. In the next episode, I will be talking with Natasha Tucker. If that name is familiar, it's because she is married to Kevin Tucker, whom I interviewed back in season 2. Natasha and I talked about a range of things: rites of passage, grief, civilization, homeschooling, and LGBTQI folk. But today, we have Ainsley Rowan back again.
...33-year-old Dr. Ainsley Rowan was born in and grew up on a farm outside Gore and currently lives in Fielding, New Zealand with her husband Cam and their 3-year-old son Arthur. Some of Dr. Ainsley's greatest achievements in life have been graduating chiropractic college, completing the Coast to Coast multi-sport race in 2015, finishing second, and growing a baby. Ainsley founded the Live Chiropractic Clinic in Auckland, a space that is both healing and nurturing for the community to visit. Currently, Ainsley runs her Brain Under Construction company, which offers courses to further educate and empower parents on her specialty topics. Last night, she had 8 hours of sleep, and for breakfast today, she had cereal and an egg muffin. Ainsley, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Emily, thank you so much for having me on. It's an honour to be here.
So after we spoke last year, we agreed that there were many more topics we would love to discuss. So here we
are. So many topics.
Yeah. So here we are back again. Maybe to start with, you could share some of your thoughts on movement patterns for parents.
Yes, absolutely. This is such a cool topic, and it's one that I'm trying to create more awareness around. Obviously, in my field as a chiropractor, I am quite often the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. So I see a lot of injuries or people in pain that don't necessarily need to have gotten to that point had they had a little bit more support around movement patterns of everyday life and how to decrease that overall loading in their body. This is especially prevalent when it comes to new parents, because you go from, you know, your movement patterns change significantly when you become a new parent. Even if you've got older children and you've had a newborn before, there's a lot more sitting, it's a lot more stationary, there's a lot more, you know, rocking, settling, patting, leaning over, changing nappies, that sort of thing. So if you think of your body like a massive rubber band, if you stretch out the rubber band, and you hold it in a stretched out position and then you try and move it from that position, it weakens really quickly, doesn't it?
Hmm.
Yeah. So you kind of think about your body as kind of similar. If you put it under load and then continue to keep putting it under load on a regular basis, it creates issues.
Hmm.
And there are small changes that we can make to everyday movement patterns, such as where your feet are when you bend down to pick up your child, whether you're lifting with your back or whether you're using your legs and bending your knees. You know, there's lots and lots of little tips that create big changes to your movement patterns that decrease loading significantly on your body and can make a really big difference to how a body feels and functions.
So this makes me think of, like, I noticed with my son, I kept holding him just on my right side. And then I found it so annoying because if I was trying to cook something, I couldn't do it with my left hand because I'm right-handed. And so when I had my daughter, I was like, right, I'm going to make sure I try and even it out. So I'm carrying her on my left side too. But I could never figure it out. Like, I would have her on my left side. I'm like, great, this is fine. I'm doing something with my right hand. And then without even realizing at some point, I had her back on my right side again. Do you have sort of, I don't know, tips for how to help balance? I don't know if there's movement things we can do to help balance that or even ourselves out.
Yeah, there's heaps you can do. For starters, this is when baby carriers come in and are fantastic to use as well, because it gets the baby is still on you, the baby is settled, but you have two hands and you have a better posture. You normally, provided the baby, you are wearing the baby carrier correctly, you have a better body position when you're wearing the baby carrier. But there is actually, people quite often pop their hip. So the baby's on their hip and they pop it off to the side, right? It creates quite a S shape within our spine. And we actually don't need to be popping our hip out to the side. So you can hold your child on your right hip, so to speak. But it depends on your body shape. Most people, I'd say 95% of people can hold their child on their hip without having to pop their hip. So it's kind of like a habitual thing that we've seen. You know, you see it in the media, you see it on TV, you see parents popping the hip when they're standing at the kitchen sink doing something, right? But we don't actually need to do that. If we soften the knees, make sure we've got a neutral pelvis, bring our hips back to center, then that baby can quite often sit comfortably on that hip whilst we're holding them.
Right. And now what about, say, picking a child up off the ground?
Yeah, so this depends on the age as well. So it's quite, but the principles stand true. What I'm trying to do is create education so that people can apply movement patterns and movement ideas and concepts to regardless of the situation that they are in. Does that make sense?
Mm.
So if you have a newborn, people quite often bend down to pick them off the floor, and they bend their knees as much as they need to, but mostly hinge at the hips. But if you step alongside that baby, so put one foot up by the torso of the child and one foot down by their feet, and you squat down in that split lunge position, then lift the baby to your chest and then stand up, that creates a lot less loading on the body than it does if you, because quite often parents will pick up the child and then swing them up to their chest as they stand up.
Mm.
It's like, it's kind of like one big swinging movement.
Yeah.
But even, which actually increases load, especially into our lower back. So even if you were going to not bend your legs, even if you brought that child to your chest and then stood up, it still decreases that load in the lower back.
Right. That's good to know.
So the thing about movement patterns is changing. You don't have to change all of them, and no one's perfect. You can't always pick up your baby and hold your baby in a particular way. But if you change your movement patterns by 20%, so, you know, if you go to pick your baby up 10 times and twice you use a different, you know, more ergonomic positioning and movement pattern, that decreases the load at the end of the day on your body by 20%.
Huh, that's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah, and 20% is huge.
Yeah.
20% can quite often be the difference between injury and not. And obviously there are lots and lots of factors that come into injury. You know, if you fall over, or if you've had other stuff going on pre-baby, or, you know, what happened in your birth and all the rest of it. So there's lots and lots that comes into this. But I think the crux of it is, if we can get parents to move smarter, their bodies will thank them for it.
Yeah. Nice. And
it's not that hard.
Yeah, no. I think it's just being conscious of it in the moment while you're doing it, to be able to make those slight adjustments, even if it's just for that 20%.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also building it into rhythms and routines. So it's hard to create change if we try and do everything all at once. And it's hard to create change, and it takes up a lot of brain power, because parents don't have a lot of brain power. You know, when you've got small children, you're using all the brain power that you have just to make sure everyone's fed and changed and,
yeah,
and, you know, watered. So it's better if we can make small changes consistently. And, you know, every time I pick up the child after I've changed them, or every time I'm putting the child down to change their nappy, I'm going to use a smarter, more ergonomic movement technique.
Mm-hmm. And now, I saw a post you did maybe a week or so ago of the same sort of thing, but movement in pregnancy, like getting dressed or putting on shoes.
Yes, yeah. This makes a big difference as well. So how we move through pregnancy can change how our body functions. So we've got a lot of relaxin in our body. Our body changes shape significantly when we are pregnant.
Mm.
So we want to make sure that we're not creating any shearing or extra loading that's unneeded when we are pregnant. So, for example, if you are 35 weeks and super fit and strong and manage to keep that up throughout pregnancy, then you can probably stand on one leg quite comfortably and put your undies on and your socks on and your pants on. But there's not a whole heap of parents out there who are able to keep up that level of fitness, at which point sitting down on something low but solid, so like the edge of a bed can sometimes be a little bit too soft, just keeps your pelvis stable, so then you can put your socks on seated and then stand up.
Yep.
And it can make a big difference between people developing and getting pain in and around their pelvic and pubic symphysis area and lower back. So it's a great way to, you can just avoid it.
Yeah. Well, see, because this was going to be my next question, because I know a lot of people talk about aching pelvises or lower back pain and, in pregnancy. And I was going to ask, you know, what sort of tips do you have? Because I know a lot of that comes from relaxin, so you can't really just stop the hormone that is necessary. But is this kind of stemming from doing these sort of?
Well, this is a loaded question.
Yeah.
There's a lot to this. It depends on the history of that particular person. It depends on what's going on for them. How close was their last pregnancy? If they were pregnant beforehand, did they have any diastasis recti? Like, was there damage done to the body? All sorts of questions. I've gone down a rabbit hole, but I think the crux of it is, if we can improve your movement patterns while you're pregnant to create support for your pelvis as it expands, then of course you're going to be better off. And there are just small tips that we can give parents, especially towards the end of their pregnancy, which make a big difference overall for how their pelvis feels and functions, which obviously leads into birth and how birth feels and functions as well.
Yeah. So one of these tips you said was sitting on a firm surface. Is there any other small tips like that? Sitting on a firm surface when you're putting on shoes or whatever, but other things like that that we should be aware of?
Yeah. How you relax, how you sit on the couch at night.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of pregnant people, especially from about 30 weeks pregnant, would lay back on the couch, and that creates a hammock-like position for their baby to get really comfortable in, and it can lead to a baby not being optimally positioned. So we want to avoid that if possible, and sometimes that can interfere with the position of the baby in your pelvis. So we want to be really aware that when you're pregnant, especially past 30 weeks, that you're not lying back in that semi-reclined position, because it's encouraging baby out of a good position.
Right. Yes. And so what would be a good resting position then, say at night, if
you could lie on your left side, mm-hmm. or right side, whatever side. Left side's slightly better. Mm-hmm. You could sit on a Swiss ball and do figure eights with your hips. You could lie with your hands, so be on hands and knees, but have your hands over a Swiss ball so you can relax like that. Just lying back in that reclined position is not great.
Yeah. One I remember doing a lot was, like in yoga, I think it's the child's pose where you're just like that, but then I'll just kind of prop myself up on my, I'm in like a frog position, I guess, with my legs, but leaning forward. Yeah, and then if I'm watching something or reading something, I can just do that in front of me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Okay. Now, so you share a lot of wonderful information on social media, and there are a few posts I've seen recently, like I've just said with this being pregnant and putting on shoes. So there are a few that I've seen recently that I love to talk to you about more. So the first would be like milestones. Like how necessary are our milestones?
Right. So without milestones, as a human, our brain matures and our body matures with it. So milestones are a sequence of physical movements that allow us to move as an adult. And there's lots of controversy as to whether, for example, crawling is a milestone.
Mm-hmm.
Because technically speaking, you can be an adult and not have crawled and still be successful. But if you are an adult and you've never learned to sit up, that might be a problem.
Mm.
So milestones are really important. I'm quite big on milestone education, and I've got a lot of online courses revolving around teaching parents about milestones. And mainly I'm trying to take the panic out of milestones and educate parents on the mini stones. So mini stones are the smaller physical movements that a child works on in order to master that bigger milestone, because people get so focused on those bigger milestones. They get so focused on the rolling, on the crawling, on the sitting, and on the walking, that they forget that there's actually a really beautiful process unfolding to get to those milestones. So I get more excited about the mini stones, those smaller physical tasks that need to happen and get mastered before a milestone is achieved, because those in themselves are just as beautiful and just as amazing as those big milestones. So if we can educate parents around what those mini stones are, parents know that their children are on track. And this is a big one, because it can reduce a lot of anxiety. Milestones have really, really varying age timelines. So I'm not sure if you're aware about this, but the CDC in America has just released a new timeline for milestones. So for example, let's use sitting. Unsupported sitting has previously, said around that it will be achieved around the 6-month mark. But the new CDC guidelines have said unsupported sitting is expected by 9 months. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot to unpack here, but basically the CDC hasn't necessarily changed the guidelines. What they've done is changed the percentage. So by the age of 6 months, 50% of humans will be sitting unsupported. By the age 9 months, 75% of babies will be sitting unsupported. And that's a normal development progression. So basically what they're doing is they've pushed milestones out, so to speak, so that because that 6 to 9 months is still, all of those babies learning to sit unsupported in that 6 to 9 months are still within normal limits, but they were in a system where they were seeking support, but they didn't necessarily need it because they were still normal. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But there's lots and lots of pros and cons to the CDC, the new CDC guidelines, and I am not going to delve into that right now because it's very complex and there's lots to it. But I think it's really important for parents to understand that development is a spectrum. Every child is very different. There are lots and lots of things that impact development that are out of our control, but there are lots of things as a parent that are in our control. And there's lots that we can do to facilitate and optimize development. And I think that power has been taken away from parents. So that's what I'm trying to give back. I'm trying to educate parents around what milestones happen when and the mini stones leading into milestones so parents can be really well-rounded and have confidence in the development journey.
Yeah,
they know that whilst their baby is 7.5 months and not sitting unsupported yet by themselves, they know that their child is still working on these other mini stones that will lead them to sitting, so they can be less panicked and let their baby do what they need to do in their own time. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
On the flip side, it means also means that parents are educated enough to go, okay, my baby is 7.5 months. She has none of the mini stones that she should be showing by now, which means that I need to get professional help. And so there's like, you know, you get those parents that don't know if they should be asking for help. And then you get the parents who ask for help even though it's not needed. Mm. So we basically, I'm trying to create education so that we can have babies that with parents that are calm, confident, and secure in what's going on.
Right. Could you give us an example of some of these like mini stones?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a mini stone, what milestone would you like?
Okay, so let's say, because we've been talking about sitting, so let's say, for example, a couple of mini stones for sitting.
Okay, yeah. So this sounds straightforward and basic, but a mini stone for sitting would be that a child can roll confidently both ways.
Right.
Seems basic, right? Mm-hmm. And people don't necessarily understand that rolling both ways builds up so much muscle tone and coordination in the core of a child that it helps them stay upright when they're seated, when they're in a seated position.
Right.
So, yeah, so it's like a ladder and like a chain. Everything's connected to something else and everything happens for a reason to be able to build to that next step. Mm-hmm. So when parents understand that, it helps them facilitate and optimize development for their child. Because if you're helping a child to sit before they can confidently roll, they may learn to sit with enough practice and perseverance, but they won't be steady. They won't be able to get themselves in and out of sitting. And you're potentially taking time away from a part of the brain that actually needs to mature.
Right.
With the rolling.
Yeah. I've been going in like two different directions while I was listening to you talking. So on one hand, I was curious about these mini stones, but what if you, like you were saying, somebody whose child is 7.5 months and they don't have any of the mini stones, they might seek professional help. What sort of professional help would be provided at that sort of age?
Yeah. So we've got a couple of avenues that you can go down. First and foremost is GP, because your GP will be able to do a small assessment and then direct you out to the appropriate practitioner or specialist, and you can get in the pipeline for that. Another step would be to see a peds chiro, peds physio, peds osteo privately.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so those are kind of the two channels.
Yeah. Cool.
We've got some incredible peds physios in the healthcare system. So that would be where the GP would most likely direct you, or potentially they'd send you to a pediatrician first for an assessment who then may refer through to the physios.
Right. Cool.
It depends. Yeah, it depends on the system.
And do you have more about this on with braining? I've forgotten what it's called.
Brain under construction.
Yes, like my brain's under construction. Yeah. Yes, you do. Do you have this in a course?
Yes, I do.
Yep.
So I'm currently working on the fourth trimester development course, which I hummed and hawed about whether to put together. So I have the Tummy Time Project, which talks about tummy time, how to do it, how to troubleshoot it if you're having difficulty with it, how you can get it in a really beautiful, calm, connected way that's really respectful for your child. So that's excellent. Then we've got the 3 to 6 month development course. So that takes you through all of the development between, or motor development between 3 and 6 months old, how to facilitate it and how to optimize it. And it gives you a few tidbits along the way, like I think we talk about sitting containers such as Bumbos and a few other bits and bobs, like how to pick a high chair and what things to look for to know that they're ready to start solids and stuff like that. Then we've got the 6 months to walking course, which is very large. It's a large topic to cover. And we basically take you from 6 months of age all the way through to walking confidently. So it shows you how to optimize and facilitate, or educates you on how to optimize and facilitate all of those mini stones and milestones to get to a really confident walker, which is really, really cool. And we talk through, you know, jolly jumpers and push walkers and whatnot as well. I also have the baby container project, which talks about how to use baby containers properly, because there is, so a baby container is anything that a baby is contained in, or anything that holds a baby, so anything that restricts movement, natural movement of that child, or anything that holds a child in a position that they couldn't get themselves into. So for example, a jolly jumper is a baby container, a capsule is a baby container, a bouncer net is a baby container, but so is a pushchair. So a lot of people, some people know about baby containers and they are like, you know, it's like a bull to a red flag. They go, oh, they're horrible, never use them. But actually, there's no problem with baby containers. The problem with baby containers is how they get used, or the problem, any problems that may come from baby containers are how they're being used. And herein lies a problem. The marketing companies, there's no one holding them accountable, especially not in New Zealand. So in other countries, there are particular baby containers such as exosources and sit-in baby walkers that are illegal. But that New Zealand is none the wiser. So we don't have any regulation around baby containers, and toy companies, anyone can make anything and sell it, and sell it for astronomical prices, by the way. And also anyone can make something, but the disclaimers on them and the instructions are not based on the development of the child, which blows your mind, right?
Yeah.
Like, I've been talking about this a little bit recently and people are just confused. How could this be possible? You assume when you are buying a baby container, regardless of what sort of baby container it is, you assume that the company that has made it has gone out and done the research to give you a product that is going to help facilitate your baby, help facilitate your baby's development and really, really optimize it. But actually, unfortunately, it's 100% about money. So the Baby Container Project is another passion project of mine. It basically runs you through the three main categories of baby containers. So you've got lie in, sit in, and push along, and how to use them in a way that facilitates and optimizes development rather than hinders it. If you have a child that spent a lot of time in baby containers, such as, you know, they might be in a capsule and then they get put straight in a pram, and then they get home and they get put in a baby walker or an exosaucer, and then they get put into like a cocoon, you know, those baby swing things. They're kind of like a cocoon, but they are electronically swing. And then they get, you know, like they just move from baby container to baby container. That may, depending on lots of other factors, impact their development. So, yeah, the Baby Container Project is a really, really, really cool resource for parents to have, because it not only teaches them to use what they've got in a way that's really, really safe and great, it's also means that they can pick and choose what containers they might want in their household as well.
Yeah.
So it's a really great resource for pregnant people, but also I have deliberately with all of my content, I try and make it non-judgmental and really like, here's the information. Now you can choose to use that as you see fit.
Yeah.
So it's a great, great resource.
Yeah. And it's good the way you're bringing awareness to just understanding that use of it rather than being like, oh, this is what everybody does. Be like, oh, hey, yeah. Actually, I'm going to be thinking about this, like consciously making the decision how often, how frequently I'm going to use these containers.
Yeah, and there's so much to it. Like, I could unpick, you know, for example, you know, baby jumpers.
Mm.
They came into fashion in the 50s, right?
Yeah.
But they were sold. They did such a fantastic job of marketing that they are still sold on the premise of those marketing, of that marketing, or on the tail from that marketing campaign back in the 50s.
Wow.
How crazy is that?
Yeah.
And the premise of how they sold them in the 50s was your baby needs to exercise. So this is the number one lead baby exerciser. So it was brand new. Also, your baby will eat better and your baby will sleep better if you use this, right? So that's tying in diet culture to babies.
Yeah.
That blow your mind?
Wow.
Like diet culture is everywhere, but to actually prey on parents who just want a little bit of sleep and would really like their babies to eat well is just criminal, isn't it?
Well, yes, it was very good marketing.
Yeah, and it worked.
Yeah.
It worked. Yeah, because now baby jumpers are baby jumpers are a harness, and then they go up to a spring, and then they usually have a bracket that clips around the door.
Yep.
For anyone that doesn't know what I'm talking about right now, I won't use a brand name because there's lots of different types of brands that make the same thing or similar things.
Yeah,
it's a brilliant marketing campaign, and the sales, they're not really marketed anymore because they don't need to be, because they've become a household staple.
Mm. Yeah,
if that makes any sense.
It does, yeah.
So yeah, I taught people through how to use, you know, pros and cons of them, how to use them in a way that facilitates and optimizes development, and yeah, it's really cool.
Yes. So now on your website you have a free baby eyesight development guide. So what can you tell us about the vision of newborns?
Yeah, well, this is really exciting. It's probably more exciting for me than anyone else, but a lot of people don't know that babies can't see like adults can because it takes time for their eyesight to develop. So basically that's just a free giveaway. You just pop in your details and I email it through to you. And it's just a free guide that tells you what your baby can see at what ages. So initially they can't really see much and it's really hard for them to focus on things. And that guide comes with some black and white images that you can print out, and it gives you lots of examples of how to use them. So that in a way that helps facilitate and optimize your baby's eyesight development, which is really cool. You know, initially they're only going to see black and white and they can only see about 30 centimeters. Everything else is fuzzy if you get that far away. So if we think back to what that gives a baby, it gives them connection from breast to their parents' eyes.
Mm.
Yeah. So it's distance. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's pretty beautiful that they are born with enough eyesight to be able to see their parents' faces.
Yeah. And because your images are black and white, are they only seeing that, they're not seeing much colour at that age?
No, they're not going to see colour for a while yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So black and white, large, bold images can be really, really great to help them learn how to focus.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like if you threw, you know, a multicolored comic book at them, it would be really hard for them to focus on anything because nothing really stands out to them.
Right.
Yeah. So black and white images that are really bold are slightly easier for them to focus on. It's kind of like training wheels.
Yeah.
You know, just helps them learn.
I downloaded this development guide and so I saw all your black and white images. So I really like that you've, you know, shared those to help facilitate eye development. And I guess you said that that'd be good for just to stick nearby if they're like on the floor having tummy time or wherever you're changing them or just in like places where they can see them and focus on them. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. If you have a, like a play gym, then you can take off the colourful toys and pop them on to begin with as well. Mm. And I'm actually surprised by the amount of messages that I've had from parents who have downloaded them and said, holy moly, thank you so much. This has been a game changer for changing a nappy. So they've had a child that's just screamed through, or a baby that's just screamed through nappy changes since birth, and they've tried everything to do, you know, connect during changing nappy times and tried everything, and then they just downloaded this free guide, blue tacked the, or sellotaped or propped up the images or one image on the side of the change table, and the baby has something to do. Wow. And has been calm. Yeah. So I have been blown away by the amount of people that have sent me messages along those lines, which is really cool. So I think sometimes babies can get bored, and it's not really a concept that we think about much, is it?
Yeah.
As parents.
And I guess I'm quite interested in the whole, I'm still interested in this black and white, because everything for babies and young children is so bright and colourful. And I'm thinking of, when can you start introducing colour to those sort of images for them?
Yeah, colour comes in slowly. And I actually talk about that a little bit in the guide. Mm. Red, I'm pretty sure red is the first colour to come in. Oh. And so it's interesting because some books, especially young children's books, will be black and white, and they might have a little bit of red in them as well.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. But I think the initial phases of that black and white and getting that focusing and the tracking, because initially they like focusing on something mm-hmm. is a big deal. Just focusing on one thing, because their eyes are drifting apart and they don't have the muscles to even be able to, you know, focus on something.
Yeah.
So initially those black and white images, bold images to begin with, just set the foundations.
So now you're saying that it was, when they're born, it's roughly about 30 centimetres. So is that about how far away you're wanting these images to be? Or like, I'm thinking of, what about when they're 1 month or 2 months? Like, at what point can you start to make them slightly further away?
I talk about this in the free guide. Yeah. I give you specific distances.
Yeah.
So it's all laid out super easy.
Yeah.
So then you can, you know, roughly how far they can see it, roughly what age.
Cool.
And then you can kind of start to space things out and move them away.
That's good. Okay. Now, I really appreciated one of your posts about why it's important to stop helping children. So can you tell us why?
Yes. I'm a parent. I get it. Honestly, I see my child climbing up on the edge of the couch and then trying to walk along the back of it, and every ounce of me wants to help him get down. Probably shouldn't be walking along the back of the couch, right? Setting himself up for an accident. But what we need to realize is our children doing unsafe things safely is them learning. So quite often as a parent, it's really easy to step in and break up a really integral learning moment for that child. And they need to learn. They need to do these things by themselves to learn. So if you have, you know, a child who's learning to crawl upstairs, and if you always are there to help and support them, then they don't necessarily, obviously, if there's ever any danger, then you want to step in. Like that just goes without saying, right? But if you check the environment, they're not in too much danger. If they do fall, they're not going to hurt themselves that much or hurt themselves at all, then falling is as important as mastering movement.
Yeah.
They need to learn how to fall. They need to learn where their limits of their body are. And if they never fall, then they can't learn those limits. And children, you often see parents interrupting moments of play where the child might be doing something slowly that looks dangerous. For example, they're climbing up onto the trampoline by themselves, right? And they might be, I don't know, a year old, and it's quite a hard task for them to do, but they're managing it and it's in slow motion. And so yes, you can be there in case they fall or to stop them from falling, but actually letting them achieve that by themselves, they learn more than we could ever teach them.
Mm, yeah.
So taking a deep breath, making sure that they're safe in their environment to some extent, and then taking a step back is so hard as an adult.
Yeah.
So hard as a parent. But it's so important.
So important to allow them that space to learn and occasionally make mistakes. My daughter is very much into like taking every risk she possibly can. And I've reached the point where I'm like, sometimes it's better to just, as long as you know that she is safe, it's just better to not watch.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is that every kid has a different personality, a different temperament, and a different risk appetite, just like adults.
Yeah,
I've got a very low risk appetite. I'm a very safe human, especially with movement. I will analyze a situation, make sure that I am confident that I can execute a task, and then I will execute it, usually successfully. Whereas I've got a lot of friends who would not really think about it as much and just do it, fail a couple of times, and then nail it. So kids are like that as well. Yeah. And you can probably, adults are just a little bit, we're a little bit quieter about how we do things. But adults analyze their own movement patterns too. So every kid is very different. Some kids are, their risk appetite is really low, and you are probably going to have to step in more than with other kids.
True, yes.
Because if they are going to climb that tree all the way to the top and have absolutely no concept of falling or how to get down, then that's going to lead to problems. So obviously step in for that kid. But also, this kind of leads us into sensory appetite. So that kid obviously loves to move, loves the vestibular challenge of climbing a tree. So what is that kid telling us? What do they need more of in their, sensory appetite throughout a day?
Mm.
So we could break it down and say, I mean, we're kind of going off topic here, but you know me.
I like this.
get on a roll. So, you've got those kids that have a lower risk appetite. They don't need as much vestibular input. They are probably going to be slower, safer movers than those other ones who are moving a lot, will challenge themselves, will fall a lot, and probably have those bigger accidents and injuries. So as a parent, it's our job to kind of, monitor, register, figure out what the risk appetite of our child is and what that sensory profile for that child is, and then try and meet those needs. So if you've got a kid who keeps climbing over the fence and running away, that's actually came from a friend. I can't remember what friend it was. Keeps climbing the fence and running away. Anyway, she was able to figure out a way to give that child that sensory input in the backyard without that child needing to climb the fence and run away and get that sensory input elsewhere.
That's good. I suppose that's what probably the child just wanted to climb.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure many people in our culture feel the pressure to bounce back after birth, back to their pre-pregnancy bodies, back to somehow continuing with the life they had prior to a baby whilst also meeting all the needs of a new human. And doing anything less than this is like almost seen as a failure in our culture, which is very discouraging. What can you share with us about postpartum movement?
Oh, I'm on a rampage with this at the moment. I really want to create more education around the fact that there is so much to birth recovery. And people often call it, even myself, I'm calling it birth recovery, but people forget it's pregnancy recovery as well. Our tissues stretch an insane amount while we're pregnant, right? And then we give birth and people expect that their body is going to bounce back just like that. And the reality is that that's just not how physiology works. It's not how anatomy works. It's not how healing works. So we need to create more awareness around this. And I think if once people start to understand that physiological response and process, then it will be more common that people are able to give themselves the space and time that they need to recover. And I'm not saying not do anything. I'm just saying that depending on your type of pregnancy, did you have your head in the toilet for the entire pregnancy and couldn't and were bedridden? And then did you have a three-hour labour that ended up in a in-theatre C-section?
Mm.
You know, like that person, their recovery process is going to be completely different from the gym bunny who got no morning sickness, never threw up, ate an impeccable diet pre and during pregnancy, had a straightforward, zero-tearing, four-hour vaginal birth with, you know, not minimal abdominal separation, and, you know, that recovery process for that person looks completely different to the first person I just spoke about.
Okay.
And so in our society, everyone's got this 6-week thing in their head, and I'm like, it's not that simple. Mm. It's not that straightforward. And we need more awareness around how pregnancy, birth, and recovery looks different from person to person. I read somewhere many, many years ago, and I'm not entirely sure where it was that I read this, but I'm gonna tell you about it anyway. Apparently, the 6-week recovery frame comes from some research that was done a long time ago that says that by 6 weeks, most people who have given birth can engage their core again. Right. So I'm not sure, people aren't really familiar with this concept, and I can see that you are also very confused when I'm talking about this. But after you gave birth, were you able to engage your core muscles? Were you able to switch them on?
I can't remember.
Okay, so yeah. After birth, it's quite normal, depending on the pregnancy that you've had and depending on the type of birth that you've had, that some people can't switch their muscles on. So I physically couldn't engage my core for 10 weeks after birth, right?
I see what you mean, yeah.
And at 10 weeks, I could only switch on one side of my core.
Ah, okay.
So obviously my birth process, my pregnancy was rough, my birth was rough, and my recovery process was on the longer end of the spectrum. But if we talk about it like this, and there's so much to birth recovery, but if we just break it down and we just talk about when can you engage your muscles again after giving birth, some women or some humans are going to be able to do it straight away, and some humans aren't. So this is just a really great example of how birth recovery looks different for every individual, and how we need to create a more accepted framework for recovery after pregnancy and after birth.
So I'm just thinking, like, I think I understand what you've said, but like the core encompasses so many aspects, like even just like sitting up is using your core, right?
Yeah. Walking. Breathing.
Yeah. Exactly. All those things. So like, for example, when you said that yours took 10 weeks to recover on one side, and that the research from a long, long time ago said about, what, 6 weeks roughly?
Yeah.
What is that specifically referring to? Because like you said, so, breathing.
So what it means is that pregnancy and birth changes our body physiologically. And sometimes when you're laboring for an extended period of time, it takes a lot of energy for muscle tissue, for tissues, essentially. You know, like if you were to run 100 kilometers right now, after that, you'd probably be pretty sore and pretty fatigued, and potentially so fatigued that some of those muscles just wouldn't really engage that well, even if you wanted them to.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You with me now?
I'm understanding now. Yes. Because I remember after my births, I just didn't even bother trying to do any sort of exercise that used my stomach. I was like, as long as I can, walk to the toilet or sit up to breastfeed the baby, that was enough for me.
Yeah. And there's lots that we can do to help facilitate and help repair. And, you know, movement is super, super important.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of experts out there, especially postpartum movement experts, who can help guide people back to health and help and get these get things working again, essentially. Mm-hmm. But we do need to understand that tissues take time to heal, you know, and for those people that are back running at 4 weeks postpartum, they are putting themselves at risk of, you know, prolapses.
I think that's really important to bring to light as well. Yes. Yeah,
absolutely. Because, and a lot of people think that, you know, if you imagine that your pelvic floor is a hammock and that when you're pregnant, you add in like 4 oranges to that hammock, that hammock has a lot more load on it than it does without those 4 oranges in that hammock. So that tissue is going to take a little bit of time to recover after having all of that weight on it for 9-ish months.
Yeah.
And then from also yielding through that birthing process as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good way to look at it. And so I guess along these same lines of postpartum movement is postpartum sex. So
yes.
I believe the Western medical guidelines are wait 6 weeks, and that's about all the advice given. So, yeah, what deeper insight can you offer here?
Well, getting back to sex after birth is a spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of people don't talk about it because it's almost like a taboo topic, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I've started talking about it a little bit, and you've got some people that absolutely love it, and then you've got some people who send me messages saying that it's not okay for me to be talking about this. And I just think that we need to discuss these topics. No one is talking about them unless you have a really great friend, a group of friends who gave birth at similar times. Then you won't be discussing this. And actually, even within a group, maybe you wouldn't discuss it honestly, because maybe you're 6 months postpartum and you're not ready yet for various reasons.
Yeah, that's very true.
And maybe your friends have been having sex, you know, since 6 weeks postpartum. Everybody is so different with regard to, you know, and there's lots that comes into it. How much sex did you have before you got pregnant? How much sex did you have during pregnancy? How much, you know, is sex within your relationship a really fundamental part for you? There's lots to unpack here, and I actually really want to get there's a sex therapist that I would love to get on board to speak about this specifically, because I talk about sex with regard to recovery and a timeline, and I just want to shine a light on the fact that sex after birth for some people is really straightforward, and for other people it takes a lot of time, a lot of repairing, a lot of healing. And things, you know, things feel different. And for some people, when they're still breastfeeding, things are drier and not as comfortable. And, you know, our hormones have a lot, a role to play in sex after birth as well. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize that. They're not aware that, oh, if I'm still breastfeeding, actually my hormonal profile is slightly different. So I might actually be a little bit drier, and it might not be as comfortable as what it used to be.
Yeah. And like, I'm also thinking of this along the lines of what you said before about, say, somebody who was, what, like 4 weeks postpartum and went for a run, and then they're dealing with, like, prolapse issues. I'm thinking of that in terms of, internal issues, and also recovering from whether it's been, like, a tear or stitches or anything like that. Do you have advice there?
Yeah, I think that my advice, first and foremost, is always that we need professionals on our team. So we've got amazing pelvic floor physios in New Zealand, but unfortunately they're not always accessible depending on your location, depending on whether you have funding. So you can always get help through the GP if you need it. You just might have to push a little bit harder to get it, but there is help there for us, not as much as there should be, and we're pushing for more, and hopefully we'll get more, you know, hopefully down the track, after every birth, everyone gets, you know, 10 pelvic floor physios to tide them over a couple of years so that they can really get back to where they want to be.
That's good to that would be good. Do you have any sort of do's or do nots regarding postpartum sex?
Well, my first comment would be, you've got to be ready. And I think there is sometimes a mindset out there that, if I just do it enough, I will be ready.
Yeah, true.
Or maybe if I just rip the Band-Aid off, I've just got to do it, and then it will be fine. And I think there's not really a huge amount of people out there saying it's okay to wait until you're ready. And if you're not ready, it's also okay to talk to someone about that.
Yeah.
It's okay to get help.
Now, I think we've managed to cover quite a bit today. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about that I haven't brought up, or like regarding these topics?
Maybe we could just talk about balance as a parent really quickly.
Yes, yep.
I have recently thrown the concept and idea of balance out the window. Not because I don't think it's obtained. Well, actually, yes. I just don't know if balance as a parent is a healthy objective to strive towards, because I think actually if we really lean into the chaos that constantly changes, then we can find balance within the chaos, if that makes sense.
Yes, yeah. And because we were talking about this before we started recording, and just saying how, like, in our modern society, it's just not really possible, I guess, to be able to do everything. And I remember hearing a quote a couple of years ago that stuck with me because it helps me get through the day. But to be like, yes, you can have everything, but maybe not all on the same day, or maybe not all at the same time. So just being like patient, be like, right, I didn't get that done today. Maybe tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I also think that as a society, we have it drummed into us to be really hard on ourselves.
Mm.
If you are a full-time working parent, then potentially you have a little bit of guilt somewhere that you want to be at home more with your parents, with your children. If you are a stay-at-home parent, potentially you feel like you need some more you time. You know, like, I just feel like sometimes we're all striving for this balance and always looking over the fence, when actually we just need to sit with what we've got and lean into that. Yeah. Much easier said than done sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's good to, like, I'm glad you've brought this up, just to put that out there, because everybody seems to be like struggling to try and do everything and make the appearance that they're doing everything.
Yeah. And I just, no one's nailing it, right?
Yeah, no.
Sometimes I get messages from people saying, oh, you look like you have it really together. And I'm like, I'm so sorry if it comes across like that.
Yeah.
Because I'm just like every other parent, and every other parent is like every other parent.
Yeah.
So we also need to give each other a break, you know, create more of a community.
Mm. Yes. More like forgiving of ourselves as well, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for having me here. It has been wonderful to have a chat.
No, not a problem. I'll put links in the show notes to your Brand Under Construction website and your Facebook and Instagram accounts. Is there anywhere else you recommend if people would like to?
No, those are a great place to start. If anyone would like to contact me, then you can flick me an email at info@brainunderconstruction.co.nz. Yes, sure. I'm aware I made a mistake with the length of that email. Or you can flick me a message on Instagram.
Great.
I'd love to hear from anyone that has listened. Give me some feedback about what you think and how you found it, and yeah.
Cool. Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for coming back to talk to me today. I really appreciate it.
No worries. I love our yarns. They're so great.
Yeah. Now, my final question for you to end on is, what is one thing you think everyone should do at least once in their lives?
Well, push themselves past their comfort zone. But I actually don't think you should do it once. I think you should do it constantly. Because outside your comfort zone is where growth happens. And there's a time and a place to be comfortable. But I think that without growth, my journey is that I'm constantly learning, I'm constantly growing, I'm constantly trying to become, or becoming better. And so without feeling uncomfortable, you can achieve those things. Like doing podcasts. I love to I love to yarn, as you know, but coming on and doing this sort of things outside of my comfort zone. And actually showing up on social media is outside of my comfort zone. And a lot of people wouldn't realize that. It takes a lot of energy for me to create content and for me to be present. And I'm there a lot, but I'm not there because I want to be known and I am striving to be famous. It's the opposite. I'm there because people need this content. We need to be having these conversations and someone's got to do it. But do I want to be the one doing it? Not necessarily. So yeah, outside my comfort zone.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.